What up, everybody? It's your boy, Nasty Backpack. Y'all listening to the Nasty Backpack Podcast. Today, we got a special guest, Desi Girl, coming all the way from California. And Desi Girl, go ahead and give us your spiel. Give us a little intro of what you do and what part of the field you work in.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here today. So I am a clinical social worker. I work in an inpatient psychiatric facility. And called podcasts and blog, where my best friend and I chat about our personal journey with mental health, as well as chatting about mental health in society.
That's awesome. Thank you for your services. I know with going through COVID and everything, I know numbers have spiked and just overall the busyness of being in a clinic and being in a facility like that. I'm pretty sure that you guys are super busy in these times right now.
Oh my gosh. It's not as busy now, but when COVID first broke out and just the unknown and uncertainty of it, it was a disaster, I would say. We just didn't know how to do therapy with 6 feet distance and HIPAA and making sure patients felt comfortable and, you know, we were safe. So I would describe it as a disaster.
That's exactly how it was where I'm at. I mean, at first, when COVID first hit, nobody had any kind of idea how to even handle anything. I mean, we didn't even have face masks for like the first probably 2 months of COVID.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, similar kind of thought process, you know, working in an inpatient unit, we aren't really allowed to bring like personal items with us. So, you know, a mask could be used as a weapon. It could be used as you know, self-injurious items. So we were not allowed to have masks either until literally like the government. Yeah, y'all need to be wearing masks now.
Yeah, definitely. What is it about your job that that you love?
I just love the DSM coming alive. I love working with all the different diagnoses and just really helping these, you know, we call them warriors on Silent Warrior Chronicles, these patients out. Whenever I see like a light bulb, you know, flick in their head, I'm like, oh my God, you get it. Like, we're gonna be okay. We're gonna figure this out.
Yeah, that's awesome. I feel like we need, here in Arizona at least, we need more clinics that specialize in mental health and SMI clinics. We have some, but I feel like there's not enough of them.
Oh, I agree. Like here in California, I think a lot of clinics don't do pure mental health. I think a lot of it is either outpatient or more so like brief counseling and less of like that long term, really getting underneath the.
Kind of cut out there, Desi Girl.
Oh, sorry about that.
Oh, so just the last part. If you just kind of repeat that for the listeners.
Oh yeah, sorry. So like I think it's the same thing here in California. There aren't that many facilities that kind of do that therapy where we go underneath the surface and really talk about the trauma and what's going on. It's more so like brief therapy where it's like, oh, you know, I have been having a lot of stress because I moved in with a really annoying roommate. And it's just like very 6 to 10 week kind of therapy. I don't really see a lot of long-term therapy here.
I hear you. What's some of the signs that you look for and that point out those type of triggers that you, when you know somebody's about to have a breakdown?
So if it's someone I've been working with for a long period of time, I like to do kind of a relapse prevention plan, with whether it be mental health or substance abuse. And so I ask the patients kind of when they first join therapy with me that, hey, tell me what your warning signs are. Tell me what your triggers are. Tell me what do you look like when you're doing well. Tell me what do you look like when you're not doing well. It's like kind of like a game plan, that a manual per se. And then I go from there. But when I'm working in crisis, I typically just look for, like, is someone rational? Like, am I able to kind of have a conversation with them and be able to say, hey, okay, you know, I know you're upset, but let's talk about it. Let's do this. Like, can I de-escalate them? And if they're not, if I can't de-escalate them, I usually hospitalize them.
Okay. And you guys have the power to hospitalize a client if they seem to be unstable and not, you know, not be able to fit into society in a peaceful manner?
So I work in an inpatient unit. So I am the hospitalization per se, but when I was an intern, I worked briefly in outpatient, and I had the authority to do the assessment, but I had to have, like, someone higher up, whether it be a licensed social worker or a psychologist or a psychiatrist, to sign off on it and say, yeah, this person needs to be 50 to 150, or no, maybe we can bring them back to the clinic and chat with them.
Okay, gotcha. How much does substance abuse go hand in hand with mental health?
Oh my gosh, this is, like, my favorite topic. co-occurring disorders is, I feel like, 90% of mental health treatment. I feel like either a patient comes in and says, I started using substances and then developed a mental illness, or I had a mental illness and started using substances to self-medicate, and now this is where we're at today. I really don't believe anyone can only have one. I really think they go hand in hand.
Yeah, I see a lot of that as well. And see, I work in a clinic that specializes in MAT services. Mm-hmm. And I also voluntarily do outreach in the community. And it's nuts. And in Phoenix, it has just been getting like probably the amount of homelessness probably tripled just in the last 3 years. And it feels like everybody out here right now has a substance abuse problem. You know, communities that were good and, you know, were the better side of the town are no longer like that anymore. And it's just like, it's just crazy that the substance, how much the substance abuse does affect the brain and does affect people's mental health.
Oh yeah, I want to say it was, I don't know where I read it, but I had heard that after Colorado, Arizona has the highest amount of mentally ill patients.
Yeah, I definitely believe it. And like I said, there's just not enough services out here. Mm-hmm. You would think that they would be building a lot more of these, especially with, you know, with people's insurance being able to cover those co-pays and cover. I would think that they would have a lot more clinics out here, and they really don't.
And I'm surprised because I know Arizona has, like, one of the, like, more, I guess, popular substance abuse facilities. I forgot what it was called. It was in a documentary. But I'm surprised Arizona is doing so poorly in that sense, because I know a lot of, like, famous people go to, like, Arizona to get treatment. So I wonder where they're going for treatment.
Well, I know Prescott has a lot of good facilities, and I know Tucson has a lot of good facilities out there. Mm-hmm. I think it's just the rapid amount of our population coming in. You know, people that are suffering from substance abuse, like, and it basically waters into the mental health of them, and they just, a lot of them are just ending up on the streets right now. And you know, I go out and I do community outreach, and I always ask, you know, if I take you to treatment right now, if we can set up treatment, you know, to try to get you a little bit more stable. I get the amount of no's that I get, and it's just nuts. And I don't know, I feel like we got to do more out here to change the minds of everybody who is developing that's thinking about starting a substance abuse just going into that?
So yeah, I worked with the homeless population before I went to grad school for my master's in social work. And I remember when I did outreach work, I think I've only gotten one person in that 2 years I worked there to get into treatment and actually stay in treatment. And I think one of the reasons why is the mistrust of the system. I feel like the mental system, it's broken. Even like from the inside perspective, I can tell you the mental system is broken. There's so many gaps. There's no like solidification of, okay, this is how things are going to be done. Where if you compare it to like the medical sector, there's protocol. There's plenty of like, okay, if I can't go to the hospital, I can't go to my primary care, there's urgent care, there's this, there's that. And I feel like with mental health, because the professionals are burnt out from all of the BS, the patient's like, well, why am I going to deal with this? You can't even get your life together. So how are you going to help me get mine?
It's crazy that you say that, because that's exactly how a lot of these facilities are ran. And like you said, it's a broken system from the inside. And like we just got to start looking at this as a crisis in itself, because, you know, I just feel like it's just, like I said, it's just getting worse. It has gotten a lot worse in the last 5 years. I don't know if it's because fentanyl is so popular now, mm-hmm. or, you know, because that seems to be like the main drug that people are turning to right now. And I believe it's because it's so cheap and it's so readily available that people are just staying fried out on it. It's nuts. And you know, they do so much of it that, you know, the brain just doesn't heal properly from the amount of abuse that they're putting themselves through.
Yeah. So with substance use specifically, I feel like there needs to be a better way of doing it, because like fentanyl, and I forget, what was the other one that people were into like a few years ago?
I can't think of it. The Perc 30s were huge. And the fentanyl pills, they make them to look exactly like the Perc 30s. So a lot of people will still call them perks, and I have to remind them, like, you're not taking a Percocet, you're taking fentanyl, because the only way people are getting perks out here is through a, you know, a doctor and a pharmacy, and, you know, if they're buying them off the streets, then, you know, they're just getting that just straight fentanyl. I talked to somebody the other day and they told me that they were getting them for a dollar a piece out here.
Sounds about right. Yeah, and that's the thing, like, you know, from the professional standpoint, when we talk to these patients, because I feel like I do a lot more of harm reduction than sobriety. Like, exactly. A lot of my patients are more like, yeah, I don't want to quit, but I'm open to maybe reducing my use, or maybe not using, you know, such an extreme drug like fentanyl. And I tell these guys, I'm like, so you bought like, there's one patient a while back, he was like, yeah, I bought like, I think it was like 30 oxys for like $10. And I was like, are you joking? Like, there's no way on earth. And, you know, I was like, dude, it could be cut with anything. I mean, I remember patients telling me, yeah, we mix it with like baby powder, cement powder. I mean, whatever they can find, they mix it with. And I try to educate these patients and say, hey, you know, you don't know what you're getting unless you have that magical machine that can tell you. You don't know what you're putting in your body. And, you know, before fentanyl, it was baby powder, sand, you know, whatever. And now with fentanyl, like, fentanyl is so new that I feel like science hasn't really figured out how, what, when, like, you know, what are we supposed to do with this? And it's so rapidly being used right now that as professionals, we're left with like, okay, well, what do we do? Like, you know, I remember, like, just recently there was like an officer who actually got sprayed with fentanyl or something, and he like started seizing.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was like a small amount. So can fentanyl do that kind of damage? Like, And these young kids who are taking drugs or vaping or whatever, like, I just, like I said, it's such a broken system. And I feel like the world is evolving. COVID happened. Now there's going to be a mental health pandemic. And we're still trying to figure out, wait, how are we supposed to do this? Like, what help can help and what doesn't work? I mean, I just think we're not going to fix anything. We're not going to make an impact until we figure out what's the game plan.
What direction do you think we have to look at to start that game plan? And where do you think it starts at?
Personally, I think we need to look at the system we have today and figure out what's working, what's not working. Why is it not working? Why is it working? And go from there. With substance abuse, I genuinely believe it needs to be a multidisciplinary treatment modality. We cannot just have, you know, social workers and psychologists over here treating these patients. We need a medical doctor. We need a nurse. We need a case manager. We need like a whole team of people helping this individual.
What up, everybody? It's your boy, Nasty Backpack. If y'all like what you're hearing here, go to my YouTube channel, Hope for Phoenix. Like, share, subscribe. Watch me as I go through the Valley of Phoenix, doing community outreach, talking to the homeless, trying to help those who are dealing with substance abuse change their life and get into treatment. Follow us on Twitter at Nasty Backpack. You'll find me on Instagram at Nasty_Backpack. That's your boy. Holla at him. Late.
And that's not happening. I know when I was working in a methadone clinic, I literally did everything. I played the nurse, I played the doctor, I played the case manager, I played the therapist, and that's not my role. That's out of my scope of practice and my competency. I cannot be giving you medical advice, yet I'm sitting here educating you on cirrhosis of the liver.
Yeah.
Or, hey, you know, you can't mix methadone with heroin, you know, this is what happens. Or you can't be sniffing your Suboxone and using, you know, codeine. Like, I can't do it all. And I know that sounds really bad, you know, because what I hear is like, well, you chose to go in this field, but I didn't choose to play all these roles. I chose to be a part of a bigger team, a bigger initiative to help these individuals.
Yeah. No, I definitely, working in a methadone clinic, I definitely see where you have to wear many hats. And I don't know why it's like that. It just seems like every clinic has that problem. Either they're short on nurses, they're short on providers, they're short on counselors, they're short on case managers. I don't know what drives people. And then the turnover rate at a lot of these facilities is so high. For as much as we do, I don't get it. It seems like it's a backward system. But I 100% believe in methadone treatment, methadone maintenance, and Suboxone. I think both of those are great for beginning stages of treatment for a client or for somebody suffering from substance abuse.
Oh, absolutely.
I feel just if you put a good enough, overall, the patient has to want the change. Mm-hmm. And if there was a good system that was created for them to succeed, and the client did their part, I feel like a lot more people would be successful in treatment.
Oh, absolutely. I know methadone and Suboxone have such a bad name in society. It works. If it's the right environment, the patient has to want to do it. I mean, I remember having patients who came to the clinic because they just wanted methadone because they wanted to get high. But there were patients who genuinely wanted to get better, and it worked. The system worked. However, I feel like the system only works when not only is the patient willing to do their end of the bargain, but us as professionals are all there 100%, not half-assing it, not saying, okay, so I need you to do today doctor, nurse, and clinician, or case manager and this, I think we all need to work as a team, because whenever the medical doctor was involved, I felt like it was more successful. Again, methadone is a medical drug. I can't administer it. I can't sit here and tell you, oh, well, this dose is too much for you or this dose is too little for you. That's the doctor's job.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, how many times have you seen a doctor go out and do outreach work? I've never seen a doctor sit out there and say, hey, let me educate you, because this is technically my expertise. It's us case managers, us clinicians are going out there and saying, hey, look, this is what methadone is. This is what Suboxone is. And, you know, they're like, but you're not. Some of these patients who have looked into it, they're like, well, you're not accredited to tell me this information. You're not the one that's going to administer it. Like, why are you talking to me about it?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's, you're 100% right. That's, I've never seen a provider go out there or a doctor go out there and, you know, they'll sit on Zoom and do it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the people that are out there suffering are the, you know, the ones that are in the streets that are, you know, using every day. And just like I tell everybody, I feel like if you could have two exact people living in the same spot, both homeless, and one, if one's on methadone maintenance and the other one is on nothing, mm-hmm. that I feel like the one that's on that methadone maintenance is a lot more stable than the one not, because, you know, they're never going to stop using if they have no backbone in place to help them not go through the withdrawals and handle the cravings. And
yeah, and that was my next point, was the withdrawals, the cravings, all of that that comes with detoxing from opioids.
Yeah.
Again, yeah. I just feel like it's such a broken system. So much misconception surrounding not only methadone and Suboxone, but just substance abuse treatment. I mean, how many times have you heard patients tell you, well, you know, my family told me I'm no good, I'm just a drunk, or I'm just a, you know, a junkie. And no, you're more than that. You just need help. You need to figure this out so that you can become whatever else you are.
That's true. And you do hear those stories. It's crazy that, like, you would never think, you listen to a patient's story that's suffering from substance abuse, it's like every patient you speak to, it's almost like a movie that when they tell you their story, because they go through so much trauma, so much pain, and it's just nuts.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I used to do intakes, I would ask them, you know, tell me, when was the first time you used? And the age that they would tell me, I was like, what? Like, when I was that age, I was into Barbies and, you know, what were you doing? Who were you hanging out with? And yeah, you hear that it's like, no, I didn't do, you know, some patients are like, well, I just did it because it was cool. And I'm like, really? Like, you really wanted to do this? Like, inject yourself? And you find out it's like, you know, I was sexually assaulted, or, you know, I came from a bad neighborhood, or, you know, I was forced. And it's just so sad. It breaks your heart to just hear these stories. And then they're 40 years old telling us, you know, I want to stop, but I don't know how.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the sad part is you'll see in some cases, you'll see the grandpa, the father and the son all in the same place doing the same exact things, even at 70 years old from 19 years old. Like, it's, the system's definitely broken. Do you feel like our government helps out enough for the crisis of what's going on right now and with substance abuse in America?
I think they just recently started. I mean, again, I've only been working in mental health for like 10 years. So I recently started seeing the government kind of saying, hey, we're going to be dispersing X amount of money towards substance abuse or towards, you know, drug education or mental health. But again, I go back to my original point. You can throw as much money as you want at it, it's not going to fix the problem, because the problem is more so internal and less about funding.
Yeah.
And that's what I feel like. I feel like money is being thrown at things. Like, these laws are being passed. There was just a law passed recently about, like, mental facilities. Like, if someone doesn't have health insurance, like, there was some sort of system that's placed for these individuals. However, so far, everyone who's tried to use that bill has been turned away and told, sorry, you need, you either pay or you got to have health insurance.
And just the amount of issues that that causes when you have to inform a client that they can't get their medication today because their health insurance has changed and they're no longer covered. That's got to be some of the most painful conversations to even have. I mean, there's sometimes there's patients that are homeless. You know, they're homeless and they, you know, they opened up about being homeless, but they have a bill for $1,200 for their medication, and it's like, how do you ask that client for even a dollar, knowing that, you know, they haven't ate in 3 days?
Oh yeah, doc. I mean, I remember the nurses used to tell them, like, hey, you owe X amount of money, and if they didn't pay up, like, they didn't get their dose for the day, or they didn't get to see their therapist or go to group therapy the day. And you would see some of the patients would be like, Oh, okay, I guess, like, I'll just go shoot up somewhere. And others would be, they would sit there and argue with the nurses, like, are you seriously, you're setting me up for failure. And the nurses and the doctors and everybody would be like, well, I don't understand, like, that's your fault that you didn't have money. And I'm like, dude, they're homeless. Did we really think that they were gonna have, like, $10,000 in their bank account just to pay these dues? Like, there's a reason why they come here to these clinics, because we're supposed to be affordable, we're supposed to be accommodating to these patients so that they can be better and be a functional part of society and get a job and hopefully one day be able to, if we have to pay back. But right now we need to get them the help they need. Why are we so worried about the money?
That's true.
And I get the world needs money, but at the same time, these people can't, I mean, we have to be rational here. And that's, you know, from the social work perspective, a lot of people who go into, like, homelessness social work are told off the bat, you're only going to make $30,000 a year. So nobody wants to work in that.
Nobody. Yeah, I feel like social workers, case managers, anybody pretty much in the behavioral health field is, for some reason, they're shamed against making a, you know, decent amount of money. Those are usually the bottom barrel jobs. They pay very low. I don't get it. The amount of work that a case manager or a counselor or a social worker has to do to try to make a change in somebody's life is definitely, it's definitely turned the other way on it. They definitely dog out those type of employees that work in behavioral health.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know in Arizona what the laws are, but in California, like, social workers don't have title protection, which means essentially, like, you could be, like, a high school graduate and be hired as, like, a social worker, and you can have that title, even though you don't have a master's degree or anything or any education or formal training in it. And the other thing is that I think there's a mesh between MFTs, social workers, and psychologists, because psychologists aren't supposed to be doing therapy. They're actually supposed to be doing the assessments and the testings, and the social workers and the MFTs are supposed to be doing that therapy part. And because there's not many, I guess, assessment or testing positions, psychologists are eating up the therapist role and they're eating up the money. They get paid six figures for doing the exact same job that a social worker or a marriage family therapist does and is trained to do, actually.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know in Arizona if they have the same, if there's title protection there, but from my understanding, I don't think you guys have title protection either. And it's the same thing.
No.
Like, oh, I'm going to call myself a social worker, even though I have no credentials.
It's exactly like that. I have no credentials as far as schooling, just the experience of being at the facility that I've been at. And they wanted to bump me to a counselor, and I know I can be a great counselor, but it's just being in the case manager role, being able to help the clients almost like a peer support can, on top of you know, giving them the same type of treatment as a, what a counselor could do. I find it just fine where I'm at, just because it's with going into the counseling role, you know, you're doing more of the therapy, you're doing more of the paperwork, and it just, I like to be more in the field, getting my hands dirty and really trying to change the lives by helping the people with the resources that can help them, you know, get off the streets or get into treatment. But it's just, it's crazy.
And that's my other argument, because like in the inpatient setting, we kind of all have like our roles and then they mesh together. But when I was working in the methadone clinic and with the homeless outreach program, I couldn't go out there and talk to the men and women underneath the freeway bridge. Like, I was scared to death. And it was people like yourself who had that gift, had that, you know, rapport with these people, who came with me and said, hey, you know, I have a clinician with me, or hey, you know, I want to introduce you to someone. So your job is equally as important as a therapist, and I think they should pay you at least $80,000. You're putting your life in danger. I mean, I don't know how many times I saw patients threaten to stab us with used needles, with, and you know, I don't know what's on that needle. I don't know how many people have used that needle.
Yeah.
So you're paying people like movie stars a lot of money. Yes, they entertain us, but we're the ones over here, like those frontline workers who are trying to get people help. Why are we not given that appreciation? And I think that's another point of the turnover. If you're not getting paid, I'm not going to stay here. I'm not going to deal with this BS every day when I'm not getting paid anything to do it or deal with it.
That's fact. So it's basically like the community is pretty much turning their backs against the issues that are happening in those communities by glamorizing, you know, football players and actors and entertainers, and yet being in the field of behavioral health, you're, you know, you're working 60-70 hour weeks just to, you know, put food on the table to, you know, and this possibly a kid at Walmart making what you make.
Yeah. I mean, this is not funny, but like, I don't know how many times I've heard people tell me that. I'm like, oh wow, like it's just so sad. Because, and I know with COVID, I don't know if this is on the radar, I know with nurses, they're now fighting, saying, well, we don't get paid enough for this. And I wonder if mental health workers are going to do the same, because with COVID possibly leaving, I don't know, there's a mental health pandemic on the horizon. There's a huge substance abuse pandemic happening very soon, like I can assure you. I mean, Costco makes jokes about it, saying like, we sell like alcohol like water, and you know, I'm surprised there's not that many alcoholics yet.
Yeah.
I mean, so now what? Now all of us who work in the sector are going to be pretty much what the nurses were doing during the pandemic. Are you going to increase our wages? Are you going to give us protection? Are you, you know, are we going to get that same respect as a doctor? I know in the mental health world, psychologists get so much more respect compared to social workers and marriage family therapists and case managers. We are just the grunt workers.
Yeah. I feel like it's up to the individual, but the impact that you put on the client or the patient, that patient or that client will let you know where you stand. And, you know, being where I work and the clinic I work at, you know, when I started there, it was like, before I even got in the behavioral health field, I was unemployed. I was just trying to find a job. I got a call one day and they're like, yo, you want to start at this place tomorrow? Gave me the location. They just told me to show up. They didn't really give me too much information on on it being a methadone clinic and what methadone is or anything, you know. So I walk in, and I've told this story on my podcast before, but it was almost like a cloud of smoke in this old building. This building's probably like 80 years old. Dirty checkered flooring, and the first person I saw was a adult male, probably in like his mid 30s, wearing a full body pink onesie, the pajama onesies. There was another person sitting in the clinic with the pajama pants on, with the suit jacket. And I walk in, and I just didn't know what I walked into. And now I absolutely love going to work. I love, you know, helping the clients and helping the patients find their way in treatment, whether it's getting clean or not, or, you know, using every day. But the harm reductions that them coming to the clinic and at least getting their daily dose, and, you know, being able for them to just share their day with you, and, you know, maybe they do want to go into treatment, or maybe they do want to try to change their life, putting the right plan in front of them to help them succeed in that. It's an amazing feeling. Like, I wouldn't trade this job for, you know, any other field in the world, you know, because it's the impact that you can have on somebody's life is just crazy. If you engage with your clients and your patient, you know, you can definitely create that bond that try to help somebody, you know. And you know, you might not succeed in getting them clean or, you know, sober, but at least you let them know that you care. And I feel like people that deal with substance abuse and mental illness, I feel like sometimes they're lost in the system. You know, sometimes they burn bridges with their family, or, you know, family's passed away and they really have nobody to turn to. And there's nobody, sometimes they feel like there's nobody to represent them. And that's what kind of made me step out of my scope of just working in clinic and going and volunteering in the community to try to help these people out there have the voice. Because, like I said, you know, when you end up on those streets, it's usually because you know, either bad choices, you know, you burn bridges with your family, or, you know, family passed away and you have really nowhere to go or nobody to turn to. And just knowing that you can help one person, you know, is a pretty great feeling.
Absolutely, I agree. And I tell people, like, I love working in the methadone clinic. I learned so much from the patients. You know, they handed me a whole binder of policies and procedures, and this is how you do this. And I was like, look, I can't read this. Like, I gotta figure this out. And just from the patients, everything I know about substance use, early on I had said I have my certificate in substance use counseling, but literally I didn't understand it until I really spoke to these patients and worked with them, and they educated me on these things. And you know, I'm like, wow, like, that's so interesting. Like, I learned so much from you, and that makes them feel empowered. Like, wow, okay. Like, you know, there's something she didn't know, and I showed her. And I always enjoy, like, what I do with my sessions, I always tell patients, like, you know, we spend the first 30, 40 minutes talking about your mental health and substance use, and I want to spend the last 10 minutes, I want you to educate me. And they would just, like, have a field day, like, talk about football, or, you know, something happened on the streets, like the drama, and like they would just enjoy it because that was their time. I'd be like, I'm giving you the quote-unquote magic wand, you educate me. And they, you know, initially it was kind of like, oh, I don't know what to tell you, and then they would just open up and tell me things, and I was like, wow, like, fentanyl's only $1, like, and they're like, yeah, I just found it underneath the bridge and this, and I'm like, oh my gosh, like, I didn't realize it was happening right in front of my eyes. And because I'm, you know, it shows that we're so oblivious to what's happening around us.
Exactly. No, I definitely agree with that. It's the client is your best, can be your best friend in this field. You know, they'll teach you everything, and that's exactly where I learned everything from, was, you know, just working with the clients, engaging with them. And you know, that's why I appreciate what you do, because you guys are a big part, being in working in an inpatient facility, You know, you guys are a big part of people's treatments that help them actually get out of these streets and overcome their substance abuse issues. And without you guys, I feel like I always tell people, especially that they're, you know, 100% homeless, which a lot of my clients are. And I always tell them, like, look, you're already on methadone. That's going to keep you stable, but you need to really go inpatient. Like, let me call a facility for you. I can get you in over there. They have beds. Like, the work that they do over there, the amount of resources and counseling and that you're going to get, you know, the health screens, the behavioral health screens, you need that to kind of figure out your addiction and figure out what you need, what steps you need then to overcome this. And I just, you guys probably, inpatient facilities get more phone calls from me than probably most places.
But, and this is why your role is so important and why it's so important to work as a team, because again, when I was working in the methadone clinic and also now in the inpatient sector, it's you guys who are out in that field, out there talking to these people, building that rapport. Like, they trust you guys. And I always, you know, encourage them whenever we have, like, you know, their treatment team meetings, I always invite them, like, you know what, come on in, talk to me. What has been going on? What has the patient been telling you? And I feel like, you know, as you get higher up, they forget that. They forget that those quote unquote bottom people are the ones that have the rapport with the patients. They're the ones that the patients go to saying, hey man, I don't think this worked out. My clinician's like a bitch to me. She doesn't treat me right, blah, blah, blah. And it's you that says, hey, give her a shot. Like, let's talk to me. What's the issue? How can I help? And that's why it's so important for that team approach to happen there, because you have the rapport. I don't. I'm that brand new person coming into your life and telling you there's something wrong with you. And you can be there and say, look, I got you. It's okay. We're going to get through this together. And that's just not happening in the mental health and substance abuse sector. I think we've divided ourselves, and those that are higher up forget that we need to be a team and we need to work together, because these guys, some of them have family and some don't.
Yeah. And
we become their family, essentially.
Definitely, definitely. You know, we're the people that they see when they wake up, and a lot of times, you know, they at least see us once a day. And, you know, depending on what they're going through in life or what happened to them 5 minutes before they walked that door, I mean, just them knowing that you care makes all the difference in their whole day and how they go about things. And it's definitely important to build that rapport with your clients and patients and let them know that you are there for them. And I definitely get that out of you, you know, just hearing your podcast and hearing, watching a couple of your videos on YouTube, I definitely see that part of your skills that you bring to the table in helping these people succeed in whatever they're going through in their treatment. So I definitely appreciate you when it comes to you handling business in the field.
I appreciate that. And, you know, one of my goals with Silent Warrior Chronicles is, as a professional, I've seen, you know, what we've been talking about this episode, where the broken system, the gaps in services, the, you know, people dividing themselves. And I want us to all come together. I want mental health to be a team, like it is in the hospitals. I want this to be a team sport, per se, because we can't do this alone. We can't just have the psychiatrist doing it or the case manager doing it. We all as a team have to work and help these guys out and help. I mean, once we figure out a system, I think mental health will be right there with medical, but till then, we're just gonna be this, you know, excuse that people name mental health is.
No, you're totally right about that. It's like, if you have a stomach problem, you go to the doctor, they give you a referral, you go see a GI, you get your problem fixed. Mm-hmm. In behavioral health and mental health, you know, somebody comes in, especially working in a methadone clinic, because we're like the first line of treatment. So, like I said, you know, clients usually need a lot more than just methadone to even make a statement in their life. But you know, we turn them to inpatient. If I'm not making that call, setting up that cab, getting them over there, talking with the case manager over there to make sure the client got there, that client's not going to make it to that front door. And a lot of times you'll send somebody somewhere and they'll get denied at the front door. Or they'll get denied, you know, not enough beds, not enough. And it's like, that client's going to walk away and not ever want to try that again. And the system definitely got to get repaired. You know, clinics all around need to work better hand in hand. Doctors need to, they need to start looking at this with a microscope and start figuring out that minor adjustments would make a huge difference in somebody's lives. It seems like they almost written, you know, treatment off the table, and, you know, just let these people just kind of do their own thing out here. It drives me nuts, especially being in a border town, a border state. It's like they want to set the system up for failure.
Yeah, I agree 100% with you. I don't think anyone has the intentions of fixing this, because nobody has that motivation of saying we need to fix this because of X, Y, and Z. And that's why I said this pandemic that's in the horizon, what's going to happen now? Because there's high turnover in mental health. So in 6 months, someone could be like, I'm out, I'm done, I'm burnt out from this. And there's not enough mental health workers being spewed out of schools, or, you know, saying, hey, yeah, I'm going to give it a shot and become a case manager. So what are we going to do with these patients? Like, are they just going to rot in the street until they die? Like, what's the game plan? And I think we're asking these hard questions, but nobody has the answer.
Do you think, being that you live in California, I live in Arizona, we both have a border to Mexico. Mm-hmm. What do you think the damage is going to be on those kids that are in these facilities at these in these border towns that are coming across the border?
Oh my gosh, I have seen, like, in the news and just reading online, those poor kids. I hope they're getting the mental health care that they need. I know someone who actually works in one of those facilities, and they told me there's no mental health there. They have mental health workers there, but those mental health workers are glorified, overpaid babysitters. They don't do any treatment in there.
Wow. Yeah, I sit here and I think about it. I'm like, the mental health of our country is going to go haywire in a couple years, and the numbers are just gonna keep on spiking and keep on spiking. And it's, I heard a statement one time from somebody in the film. They were like, yeah, business is good as usual. And when they said that, it was just like, as sad as it is to say that, if you work in the behavioral health game, you're always gonna have a job, because there, it seems like they're just trying to make the problem worse instead of, or maybe not make it worse, but just neglect it at 100%, where it's like, yeah, let's just open up the borders, you know, we'll bring everybody in, we'll put these children in cages, we'll let all the drugs go across, and then we'll just spike up the numbers of mental health and substance abuse. And, you know, it's just like, I felt like they did this in like 2006. Mm-hmm. With letting all the pharmaceutical companies just prescribe whatever they wanted. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they're doing it again. I don't know if it's tied to a certain party. But I know, like, currently nobody cares about any of these issues.
And that I go back to, who are we supposed to ask these questions to? Who's responsible? Like, you know, you and I, we're doing our part. We're working the field. We're helping these people out. We're trying to figure out, hey, okay, let me put you at this inpatient. Okay, fine. You didn't get in there. Let me do this. Like, we're hustling. We're doing our part. But we can't do everything. This is a bigger issue, bigger than us. So who do we go to? Who do we say, yo, you need to help us out? Like, what do we need? And you know, I know they throw money because I've seen a lot of like these grants and bills being passed, but I don't see any change. And even in the inpatient sector, like I've seen patients thrown out midway through treatment because their insurance expired or their insurance said, okay, she maxed out on her sessions. Like how an insurance person does not have a PhD, PsyD, MSW, MFT. How in the world can you indicate how many sessions someone needs for schizophrenia? What if someone's so psychotic, I can't stabilize them in 4 sessions. I'm gonna need probably 4 months at least, like, to figure out what meds to put them on, if they're detoxing from drugs, making sure they detox first before we put them on meds. And it's a lack of education. Like, I don't think the policymakers do their due diligence and say, hey, let me go talk to an expert in the field. Like, hey, you know, you work in substance abuse, tell me a little about it. What do you see? What do you feel are the barriers? Like, they just make these laws up thinking, oh, this will fix the problem. And it doesn't do anything. It's just a law that you put into effect that whether we actually follow it or not is a whole nother issue. But nobody, you need to come into the field. You need to go, you know, come with you, come with me, you know, see what we do every single day, see what we deal with, learn what schizophrenia is, learn what fentanyl or methadone or suboxone or cocaine, like what does it do, not what Hollywood portrays it. And I think the media makes it far worse because the media portrays it totally different than what it really is.
That's facts. That's definitely facts. I mean, I don't know, it's gonna be hard to call, but it's definitely not getting looked at. You know, we just have to kind of just keep doing our part, keep doing what we do, and hopefully one day they figure it out. I feel like there should be like a stand, the same way they make prisons, I feel like they should make these massive residential treatment centers that do it all. They're all in one, and I feel like if you're suffering from, you know, with the proper diagnosis on the person, you know, they should be mandatory to go through treatment. Instead of being on these streets, instead of ending up in jail and, you know, just not ever getting that proper treatment. I feel like if they put everybody through treatment that needed it, I feel like they, you know, but they never look at anything like that and try to come up with a plan or a solution to any of this. So it's like, like you said, you know, it'll always be an uphill battle. But like I said, we definitely appreciate you, what you do in the field. I know your clients appreciate you and your patients appreciate you and your staff members appreciate you because, you know, being in the field, that you've been in the field for 10 years and that's awesome.
Thank you. I mean, you're doing amazing work, and we as mental health clinicians cannot do our jobs without you. You are the foundation to our work. You are the person we go to and say, look, I don't know what to do with this patient, like help me. And you giving us just simple information, it helps us. And without it, treatment could be very difficult.
That's fact. Well, it's been great having you on the podcast. Definitely gonna have to go run through your guys's when y'all ready. You guys are always welcome back on the show. And I just hope we continue to communicate and share ideas. And I'll definitely be reaching out to you for resources and, you know, different things in that aspect. You know, just get the knowledge, and because I feel like not enough people are knowledgeable of what's going on in our society and our communities, and the communities are just being infested with drugs, and you know, people are just not getting the right treatment that they should be getting. And you know, hopefully we work together and try to figure this out.
Absolutely, and thank you for having me. I enjoyed this episode. I think this is a conversation that we definitely not only need to start, but make sure that it continues. And podcasters like yourself are so crucial because, again, you can talk about it from the political side, or you can talk about it from someone who's in the field or someone who's dealing with it currently. 100%. We are excited to have you on our platform and, you know, collaborating. I definitely think that we should collaborate for September, which is National Recovery Awareness Month. So be on the lookout. I'll touch base with you off air and see what we can do in regards to collaboration.
Sounds great. Well, y'all heard it first. It's your boy, Nasty Backpack. Thank you very much, Desi Girl, for coming on the show. Y'all been great. We out.
Bye.